I want to look at something else from the past. Take a look at this here.
Yeah.
Live board.
Uh huh.
From Jeff. This looks like something you were working on there.
I was working on it.
Yeah, you were. And so talk about how we've come full circle again. I mean, what were the problems that you were trying to solve when you were working on this?
I don't even think it's full circle. It's exactly to what we've been discussing. None of these concepts or anything I've been working on is anything new. It's we now have, perhaps after this long nose of germination, we definitely have some good hardware breakthroughs, and in a lot of ways there are some fundamentally good and it took a long nose for that too on the hardware side for larger displays to finally become something that's actually tractable and achievable. We've had projectors before, and the large displays have been around for a while, but there actually are a lot of things coming together right now that make it where we're near that at a hockey stick, while acknowledging that, you know, this is just an affirmation of everything we just talked about. This, you know, the idea of a large display, which also resonates just because, again, as human beings, we tend to look at a vertical display, a vertical large space, as something that we naturally collaborate on or use to ideate on, or things used to communicate with one another on. I actually think that association with large spaces, whether it's a horizontal table or a vertical wall, mm-hmm. or a big design charrette session, those are all pretty primal and fundamental. The idea that almost you get productive when you have a workspace, a clean, large area to work on. But none of this is new. Now, the idea of a collaborative wall or a digitally enabled wall, one that we can work on in a more communal setting with multiple people around, yeah. Rather than just by yourself on it.
And you both... I mean, both of these products, I mean, what was going on back then and now, I mean, you both find the stylus to be very important, yep. in this work. Talk about that. I mean, what is it about the stylus that makes you believe that that's important to modern computing?
Well, I mean, the stylus is just basically the embodiment of a tool in your dominant hand. And for anybody doing sustained work, you actually don't like to just purely use your fingers for everything. And the idea of an implement or a tool is also pretty fundamental and basic. And whether you're doing an instrument or whether you're actually writing or whether you're...
Depends, right? But the fundamental rule is this. Everything's best for something and worse for something else, mm-hmm. right? And that basically says that for everything you advocate for any device, you have to, you shouldn't advocate for its adoption until you can articulate as clearly what it's good for as what it's bad. I gave this 360 rule for people and skills. Exactly the same 360 rule applies to devices. Right. So it's not a question, is the stylus better than touch?
Right.
Of course they're both good. Yeah. We've both been involved a lot. We've worked as much in touch as we have on pen. So when we say touch is the wrong thing here, it's not because we don't like touch. We've got a huge investment. It's very much because we do know touch and we love it, right. And when it's appropriate.
And we know what it's good for and what
it's bad for. Right?
Yeah. The idea that touch is great for everything, however, is
dangerous.
Yeah.
Speaking of automotive.
Right.
But I want to point something else that's really interesting here. A lot of the history isn't written down.
Yeah.
So let me tell you some history that you may not even know. We have never had this conversation. So what was interesting about what we were doing at the computer science lab at Park in the late 80s, early 90s, was with Mark Weiser's group, was we were building an ecosystem, and we populated the ecosystem primarily with computational devices, a handheld, a slate, and a board.
That's
and the whole notion was that they were to work together. Now, the guy, one of the key people on the live board, but not the only one, was a guy named Scott Elrod, who I think is still the current director. He's now the current the director of Xerox PARC. I did the layout of the industrial design of the PARC tab. The PARC tab, the electronics and stuff, that's done by a guy named Roy Wandt, who's a senior engineer or scientist at Google right now. Brilliant guy. Used to be at Olivetti, and that's where some of the core technology came from. The actual industrial design was done by a company called Fitz Richardson Smith, if I remember correctly. But I did the spec and them to how to lay it out. Now, this is really interesting because it's a handheld PDA. But notice the buttons are at the end so that you can hold it in one hand, and it's like a trumpet valve. So that you can operate the buttons by the same hand that's holding it, and I absolutely use the proportion of a trumpet. And that way you could chord. So you actually had seven virtual buttons instead of three, and you could do that, and it still had a touch screen, and you could use a finger, and you could use a stylus on it. Now, in the design of that, and we had pictures around. If you go outside of Buckingham Palace, you sort of say, where is he going with this? But I'll explain. There's a statue of Queen Victoria. And if you look at any photographs of Queen Victoria when they're in their formal thing, they're holding a big round ball with a cross on the left hand. That's called the orb. And this thing on the other hand called the scepter. And so I used that as the metaphor and said, the stylus is the scepter, the park tab is the orb, so that when I'm working on the live board, I can do that, but I don't want barrel switches on the button, right. But I could smooth scroll up or down or jump or do these other things by holding here, and if I wanted some notes for my talk or stuff like that, they could be on the screen. But when I came in proximity, the form factor, this tells you I'm not just making this up, because you've never seen anybody make a PDA in that shape. It was expressly made that way. And by the way, it worked for infrared, so I had to have it so it was palm up, so that IR sensor, which is right there, was still exposed, so it could still get the signals, right? That they would lock together when I'm close together. And this would be a peripheral, the button box, and some other things here. I could actually come and grab things off the screen with the same pen, because it was a resistive screen, so that the stylus I was using that's got designed for the live board would work here. And we can do it together. And yet when you walked apart, there was a graceful degradation as they disaggregated, and the park tab worked alone by itself, the live board worked alone, but when they came together, they would pair up.
Like that you was walk away from your car with your phone and
exactly.
It disconnects from
there. Those ideas were ingrained then. Yeah. The problem with that, and I used to say to Mark Weiser, Mark, you just don't understand, because the other thing that Jeff and I have in common that we haven't touched on is he was working on See You, See Me, this video telepresence stuff, and I was doing a whole bunch of stuff like that at that same time around in the from about 87 to about actually 94, and so we knew each other and this work at that time. But we had this thing called a media space, which is all this desktop full time video conference. I said, Mark, what you don't understand, this what a jerk, right? Tell Mark Weiser he doesn't understand, but he loved it because we were really good friends. He was just an incredibly great guy, and is that you think ubiquitous computing is about computing? It's not. It's about ubiquitous media, and that the Media Space project is in fact exactly the same project, just using ubiquitous technologies of a different type. But if you go one, let's come back to what I said about abstractions. If you've got this, the tool that at the pragmatic level, but you can jump up to the abstract level, you realize, oh, this is the same thing if you go to one level of abstraction. And then you can start to fold in these stuff. And that's what in some sense, Jeff and I talk about a lot, is how do we take these two worlds that used to be two very separate parts of our projects, maybe couple of this other third thing that we share is the computer graphics side, and how do they integrate in a way that is appropriate, and for whom and why, and how do you do it, and how do you match the industrial design with the software and hardware and the input and interaction techniques and stuff like that, and how does it gradually break down when you don't have all the pieces there, and how do you have asymmetric stuff, and it's hard, right? And that's okay. And that's why it takes time. And a lot of the stuff, it's not that the ideas aren't there. No doodad is ever an invention. The reason things take off is because there's a perfect storm. All of the pieces just happen to be in alignment. Everybody knew the mouse was a great idea. Bill Gates knew that from the moment he saw it. Everybody knew in 1968 that this was the future. But you needed the GPUs to come up to be able to do that. You needed bitmap displays because there were still, most people had calligraphic displays. You needed to start to design, think about icons. David Canfield Smith did that. He was one of Alan Kay's students on a system called Pygmalion. And then you start to come up and it takes time, and then you have to have, it's better with networking, and all the stuff has to be in place. And then you've still got all the legacy code in terms of skills and experience and the existing applications. You got to migrate that stuff over, and that stuff takes time. And in fact, in our world right now, to be fair to the industry as it stands right now, is that in those days you had hundreds of thousands of users. You know, Microsoft, we've got 1 billion users. We do something radical. Yeah. There's 1 billion people a day that we affect. And you can't just, that's different than some jerk from a research lab and says, here, let me show you this. This is really cool. You guys are a bunch of idiots, you poor developers. What the hell do you know? You should be doing what I'm doing. Of course, who's the idiot? It's the person who has no understanding about what's actually the implications of a change and how long you have to live with it if you do make that thing, all right? And so you've got to be careful. You've got to be mindful. And the question is, where do you find the right balance? And the point is that you have to acknowledge the conversation and ask the question first, and then have a process in terms of, and I just say it's a design question. All of these things are design questions. Design isn't just about a product or the shape of a product or the nature of an interaction. It's actually, we can design our business, we can design our culture, we can design all these things and use the same thought process. It comes back to if we do it at the right level of abstraction.
So I want to ask you about a couple of technologies that are coming up on their 20 years, things that haven't really taken off to the degree they had. One of them is haptics. Mm. I mean, I have my iFeel mouse from Logitech. I think it came out in 91. Is that something that you see on the cusp? Is haptics something that's going to be, because right now it's pretty much game controllers for the most part.
We're finding, we have this other interest. We kind of like cars, and we're car geeks. And what we're seeing actually, my last company was a branch of Silicon Graphics. I was chief scientist at Silicon Graphics and a subsidiary called Alias Wavefront. And every car in the world was designed with our software. And so I spent a lot of time in car studios. And so it was like getting paid to just like completely got paid, actually. But more than a third of the cost of your car today is in the information systems. You think you're pushing a brake pedal. No, you're not. That's the mouse to computer that's running software, and the display happens to be the calipers on the brakes. And you don't notice it, and that's good. But when you brake on ice, you can brake like Nigel Mansell, even if you're 94 years old. Thank God my dad drove in the winter in Canada at 94. So the point is this. As you move, and I think you were talking about this last night, is that they're actually, as you go sort of flying by wire in your car, they're having to reintroduce, using haptics, the feel that was of the road, right, so that it feels right. It's the same sense, if you want to think about it. The good metaphor would be in the Prius or some of these electronic cars. They're so quiet, you don't know the motor's on, and other people can hear it, so you actually introduce sound. I can't remember, but I think it's the Aston Martin. The new Aston Martins or some of these really high-end cars. I'm just replaying a recent episode of Top Gear. They actually, might it be the BMW, they actually synthesize muffler sound in the cockpit.
That's what my car does,
In order to,
give back that feel of
power, because it's a guy, right? Just driving that. Yeah. No woman's going to buy the car he has. That's not quite true. But you know, it's just like it's that mentality of the petrol head, right? Mm-hmm. And I have this vintage car, and I just like turn it on, get outside, right, listen for the twin.
You like that
the
there
back.
Isn't that much dampening inside the car, and you can actually hear everything going on. But you're exactly right. I mean, we literally were talking about this last night.
Yeah. And so it's already there. But here's the point. If you notice it, it's probably done wrong. And it's like a lot of this stuff, when you talk about sensor networks and ambient intelligence, it already works in your car. It's all there already. But it's like your plumbing. If you notice the plumbing in your house that should be embedded, it's probably because something's broken and there's stuff all over the floor. This is the exception. The rest of the time, if it's well done, it's completely transparent. And I think on haptics and stuff like that. I have a Gillette razor that has haptics. You push a button, and whoever thought you'd have a razor blade that has vibration, and it actually does make a difference. Mm. But we'll see things on a lot of interaction. Here's the problem on touchscreens. Here's why I'm not so far a fan of haptics. And down the road, I'm open-minded about it. Is that if I've got multi-touch, I might be doing different things with different fingers. Mm-hmm. And so until I see a viable
addressable
technology that can give me a different tactile feedback for each finger, because each finger is doing in a different location, doing a different thing, then I've got problems. I'm not happy. The other thing around touchscreens, I'm far more interested. One of the things I use haptics. I have this old Avanti. It's just this car. I'm driving up, and it's got the controls. There's nothing's digital in this car at all.
Yeah.
But in the dark, I'm driving up, having driven it for 20 minutes, and I can just reach out and I can feel my way around the controls because they're physical icons or ficons. That is supposedly a modern thing, but Henry Dreyfuss talked about them years and years and years ago. But I know what everything's for. I can explore, and this was leads up. The shape of the knob isn't to give you feedback, it's to give you feed forward. I can feel it to touch it to see what I'm about to do, so I don't do it if I've got the wrong knob. I make sure I'm in the right place. And then I do this feedback, tells me what I just did, that I actually accomplished it. And most of these transactions need to give you what you're about to do, so I can feel my way, confirm before I do it, and then I do the action. It tells me task accomplished right. or not accomplished. And those two things. Most people don't. If you ask around, most people who claim to know about HCI, if you say, "Tell me the difference between feedback and feedforward," they're not going to. They don't have that in the language even. And by the way, you won't find it in most of the books. That's how illiterate, how immature the field is.
Right.
We're still learning. But if I'm thinking about touchscreens and other things, and haptics, when haptics can do that, I don't want better haptics to tell me the mistake I just made.
Right.
I want the haptics that help me not to make the mistake.
Yeah. And that's 99% of all what the haptics is right now yeah. is just feedback already on something you've committed to, and that's just useless. The fantasy is multi-touch is only solved, from my point of view, one half of the Holy Grail. It'd be great to have literally that same multi-touch screen have some raised pixel, every pixel also can be raised or lowered, and you have that other Holy Grail, that individually addressable physicality of each pixel on the screen, and mm-hmm. we're quite a bit far from that, although.
But if you're into music controllers, you're starting to see things where there's servos in there so that sometimes the thing just feels like a really smooth continuous controller,
yeah.
and other times it'll introduce the notches so it feels like the slotted things like you used to have mechanically, and other times it gives you resistance as you go up and you don't even notice that. And so there are devices where that's used. I think the first instance of that I found in the literature was at the linear accelerator at CERN. They built these knobs that the behavior of the knob depended on what they were attached to. And,
right.
and so there are places and where that's appropriate. And in automotive, controller in your BMW do that? Does it give different feedback?
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't.
Yeah. But I actually, the whole electric steering thing may actually become the first real place where haptics starts becoming seamlessly, most people won't notice this, where that whole drive-by-wire of the steering is actually done electrically, and there's a lot of energy put to try to give you back some feel of the road. Otherwise, you can't have an open loop just sense of steering. That doesn't work. And the funny thing is, it just turns out that a lot of people want to put electric steering in there, not only for nothing to do with the user feel, actually. It's to try to get actual computer control of your steering so they can add things like lane tracking and auto steering mm-hmm. and towards autonomous driving.
Yeah.
So it's ironic that we kind of have to get good haptics there while the user is in non-computer control in order to make it feel like it's a normal driving experience.
So two quick things. One's just a trivia, but it's an interesting thing that sort of changed, that haptics don't have to be active.
That's right.
I did something this week. And I've been boasting all weekend. Jeff, you got to come and see. I replaced the steering wheel in my car. The steering wheel is this beautiful, beautiful wooden steering wheel as opposed to the leather one. And it's a little bit smaller, but it's got a completely different texture.
Yeah.
And just the change of the control gain ratio, because of the change of diameter, the amount I turn and the stuff, the gear ratio in some sense has changed to the wheels, to the amount of trouble, but also the tactile feel. It really, really changed in a beautiful way the driving experience. So that's one thing I wanted to say. But let's step back and say, what have we been talking about? And let's put this to the test, your question about haptics. So the first thing is, what we didn't say directly, but we walked around was reinforced, the underlying principle is everything's best for something and worse for something else. Second, we identified a couple places where haptics in the current state of the art is simply doesn't address the problem, the feed forward versus feedback. But we also identified places where they are. So like any technology on the long nose of the evolution of haptics, we've said, okay, what is the current state of the art? What are the unsolved problems? So that says that those are what we should be doing in the long range stuff in research. And we can address that if we think it's viable and important enough in the triage of other things we might be spending our time on. And at the same time, if we're going to apply haptics, here's some places where we can get real benefit right now. In fact, we already are. And in many cases where we are getting benefit of haptic feedback, whether it's active or static, we probably have to look carefully, because if it's really well done, we haven't noticed it. And we also have to look outside of the domain of just working on computers or video games. We have to look in things like cars, in factory automation, in robot controllers, and all this sort of stuff. And it comes right back to what I said about that. What have we learned here? We've learned that, invention and innovation is about better prospecting. And it comes back to Proust. What are the optics we bring? Really what that says is, do we need a Geiger counter? Do we need a shovel? What are the tools we need to bring to be more effective prospectors? What's the background and knowledge we need to do that? And I think those are all questions. And any problem we have when we're looking at new products and new technologies and we're trying to accelerate, maybe change the long nose from 20 years to 15 years, if we could do that consistently, we're golden, right?
Yeah.
And I just want that 25% improvement in that. We're right, it just become better prospectors, find the gold sooner, start to mine it sooner. And then figure out what are the ecosystems so that while we're doing the main place, the gold, we make sure that, well, in Canada, we have this problem right now. We got all this oil, we got no way to ship it because there's no pipelines and the trains are blowing up. And maybe we shouldn't be doing oil anyhow, but whatever the point is that you need the ecosystem. It doesn't matter if you've got this gold mine, if you can't get the gold or the oil to market. That's the same thing with any technology we're talking about. What's the ecosystem? Design the ecosystem. And then base your time in when you think you can deliver the whole thing. And then so you don't waste your time and get disappointed and tip your hand, because you only get one chance to make a first impression.
Yeah.
And so you want to make sure that your first product, it doesn't have to do everything, but it has to do a couple of things brilliantly.
Well, you can actually, unfortunately, make that long nose longer than necessary if they prematurely actually make it too hyped at the wrong time.
Mm-hmm.
And bring it out too early. And then what that actually does is when you show that other thing of the VR thing, that was in 91 mistakenly brought out and overhyped to the point that it probably delayed its re-examination that's going on right now later than maybe it could have been, or maybe it still would have been looked at now again. But
good example, the Apollo workstation, one of the first workstations, they implemented a touchpad for the cursor control, and they did such an incompetent job that it was really hard to sell anybody. Anybody had used that said, I've tried touchpads, they don't work.
Yeah.
Because their own experience with a touchpad was that implementation, and it was a disaster, and therefore they thought touchpads were a disaster, as opposed to it was a good technology that was implemented by people who did an incompetent job.
Right.
Or maybe that's unfair. They had no history, but they didn't know how to measure it, and it was early in the days. But if you did that job today, it would be incompetence. Then, you know, it's just growing pains.
Right.